On today's Tex Pros and Rock and Roll, we feature a band who needs no introduction. But before you can understand the powerhouse trio that Rush would become, you have to go back to the beginning. And today's guest has done just that in what may be the most comprehensive exploration of Rush ever written. My name is Chris Kosach, and I created this program to highlight the written account of music. From band bios to artist memoirs and the occasional rock doc, we are the only podcast of its kind. This is Text Prose and Rock and Roll. Martin Popoff has been called heavy metal's most widely recognized journalist. He holds the unofficial record for writing the most music reviews with more than 7,000, and he's penned 75 books on hard rock, heavy metal, and classic rock. So I am confident there is no better person on the planet to illustrate the story of Rush. It also doesn't hurt that they're both from Canada. Recently, I spoke with Martin about his book, Anthem, Rush in the 70s. You've written about Rush before. Can you tell us why you decided to write this and the forthcoming two books? Why did you decide to revisit Rush?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a long story, so I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. But so I put out the official Rush biography back in 2003, Contents Under Pressure, through this same publisher that we're doing Anthem Rush in the 70s. So that's the first thing. And then along the way, I had a Rush Illustrated History. I thought I could never write on Rush again, but that was a very different book, and I used a bunch of outside press in that one. And then we got sort of famous rock journalists to write record reviews of every album. So fine, that's a whole different book. Then I got the opportunity to do another Rush book, and that was Rush Album by Album. And I did this series of these five books like this. And for those, all we did was basically get, you know, famous people and Rush experts, and then we have a Q&A on every studio album. So that was totally different again. And then what happened was I had worked also on the Rush movie with the Banger guys, the Banger Films people, Beyond the Light of Stage. Great movie. But basically, I was in on the research phase and then transcribing that. So one day I just thought, you know, there's so much stuff we didn't use for the movie. It'd be a shame to see this, never see the light of day. What if we made a deal and I flipped them some dollars and basically said, look, if I can use this stuff, I'm going to go away and I'm going to write, you know, the ultimate Rush book or way more of a Rush book, put it that way. And I was even willing to do it even without a deal, like without even having a publishing deal. But I went back to ECW, and the way this worked well is because this is now, you know, the update of the old book, which was not very long. It was like a 66,000 word book. And so I started writing it. And, you know, based on this was going to be the, you know, the mother of all Rush books. And I quickly realized I had enough for three books. And I started partitioning it, saying, how can I break this up? And essentially what I did is I wrote three separate Rush books that are each about 125,000 words. So we got wow. Anthem Rush in the 70s, Limelight Rush in the 80s, and Driven Rush in the 90s, and in quote marks, In the End. That's the name of a Rush song, right? So it goes all the way up to the end, and now it's like this big, huge, all of these books are bigger than my previous Rush books, and the three tell the story. So it's like my final word on Rush, I swear, you know, knock wood anyways, but hopefully I won't be writing on Rush anymore. But that's kind of the story of why it happened.
I wonder, did Neil Peart's death a while back there play any part in you wanting to revisit this? Or did that just happen to happen while you were collecting everything?
No, I had actually finished writing all three of these almost a good year and a half ago. So Neil's death was much, much later. They had all been finished for a long time. And then we decided partly through laziness, partly through, look, it's painful. Let's try maybe only talk about this once. I didn't do any rewriting of the first one, no rewriting of the second one, but the last one's going to obviously need a little bit of an update to the story when we get around to putting that out. But the next one is out in October this year, and then the third one is planned for spring 2021. So we still got some time on that. But no, that was quite a shock. I didn't know anything about it. I mean, they kept it quiet very, very well. I really just found out about it when everybody else found out about it. But yeah, quite a shock. When not expected at all.
Yeah, no. And I want to talk about Neil a little bit more, but we'll talk about the chronology of the band. They are very Canadian, aren't they? They're all very humble. They're all very kind. They all come from completely different backgrounds, and yet there are a great number of similarities. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so they're from as Canadian a place as you can get, the suburbs of Toronto, so the biggest city, and it's the suburbs, and the suburbs of Toronto are just like where I grew up, which was a small town out west, which literally the houses all look the same. I mean, all the suburbs all over Canada, probably the states do essentially look the same, but they did have, immigrant parents, working hard parents. Alex and Getty's parents both came from Europe, and Neil grew up in a little more of a rural environment. So his father had a thriving farm equipment business, which Neil worked at on and off. So but he's also from Ontario. And yeah, they were very Canadian in that, probably the biggest thing is they never moved away, except for Neil, much later in life, moved to California. But Getty and Alex always lived in and around Toronto, so they never left this area. So, a lot of bands, even just for the career side of it, will move to L.A., essentially, not really New York. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. I haven't heard too many bands ever say, we moved to New York to make it. It's odd as a rock and roll band. I mean, but yeah, pretty many bands moved to L.A. for that reason. But they stayed here. But the thing is, they toured a lot in the States. They recognized right away that we have to go into the States and spend, most of our lives in the States touring to make it well. But yeah, it has been said they have these Canadian traits. They're very down to earth and kind of dependable. It's got to be the most scandal-free band with Rush. So that's good. And you even notice it in the office, in the organization, like when people sign on, basically they're employees for life. I mean, most people have been there since the beginning. They only had one manager since.
Yeah, that's insane. One manager for all those years.
And he was something like 16 or 17 years old when he started managing them. So basically he was a kid. He really was, Ray. And just a real hustler and go-getter and eventually sort of all – they learned everything by the seat of their pants, right? Mm-hmm. But, Rush didn't put out their first album until a good 5 years after they were a band, call it four. So they did pay some dues at the beginning before they were actually – they were somewhat mature guys, by the time 74, 75 rolls around and they put out an album and quickly get a deal, and the rest is history.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about that record deal because I am a radio girl, and I just think that this is so exciting because it was really a special time in music, I think, when music directors could still play a record they got in the mail and on the air and not be fired by some corporate big suit in New York City. Tell me a little bit about what Donna Halpern did and how they got their first airplay in Cleveland.
Basically, I guess the way she calls it now, I'm remembering this from the movie. I haven't thought about this for a long time, but there's a long song on the first album called Working Man. And she says we called it a bathroom song.
Yep. Oh, my God. Bathroom songs are legendary. I have to tell you, I had two or three that I would always put on, too.
So basically, they started playing this album with Working Man and Finding My Way and all that. And people were, calling in saying, is this the new Led Zeppelin record? Because if you think about it, I mean, Led Zeppelin hadn't had anything out since Houses of the Holy. They weren't going to have anything out until Physical Graffiti in 75. So, but it sounded a little bit like Zeppelin. It was heavy. It was power trio-ish. And it had this singer that, I don't think he sounds like Robert Plant, but you could say, and he did do a couple Ooh Yeahs and stuff on that. But essentially, they instantly liked it. You have to remember, there weren't that many heavy albums back then. I mean, so it stood out just for that, but it really stood out because of that voice. And then, the whole thing about Working Man, Cleveland's a working class town, and, come home, I get myself an ice cold beer and all that kind of thing, right? So it was a perfect song for Cleveland is exactly what Donna Halpern says, right? So, but basically, yeah, it kind of took off, and it was getting a lot of requests, and essentially Cliff Bernstein, who is now, you know, super big manager guy with Q-Prime, right? At the time, he was working out of the Mercury office in Chicago, and he quickly got wind of this thing, and I think the way his story, he explains it was a weekend, but he figured out, oh, you know, get it to the people higher up and let's sign this band. And essentially off of this record that was an indie record in Canada, it wasn't indie very long, a matter of a few months, and they were quickly signed to Mercury, and then, you know, stable situation basically moving forward.
And their work ethic, once these guys got going, they didn't stop. It was tour, write, studio, right? They never had a break.
Yes, for the auspices or span of the lifetime of this book, this first, you know, which one's on the book that's on the 70s. In the 70s, they were like every other 70s band, where they essentially, you're right. I mean, they put out lots and lots of records regularly. They even had, you know, all of these bands. People used to, you know, people kind of get lazy and say, oh, bands would put out two records a year in the 70s. Well, most bands only did that once, if they did it at all. But Rush is one that did that once. So they had two records in 1975, right? And they also squeezed in a live album as well. So they had lots of records, and they basically, like I say, they went to that base that Cleveland was in, along with, you know, Pittsburgh and St. Louis and Cincinnati and all these places, and essentially became one of that, as Aerosmith calls them, Blue Jean Army bands, right? You know, where it's basically teenage guys in jeans and jean jackets showing up to these shows of Black Oak Arkansas and Blue Oyster Cult and Aerosmith and Kiss and Ted Nugent and Wishbone Ash and Uriah Heep was their first big tour. But that turned out to be their anchor bread and butter place, the Rust Belt, and then down into the south, and then slowly spread out to the coasts. And Canada was just it did not even get preferential treatment. I mean, right in the very, very early days, Ontario, the province of Ontario, got preferential treatment, but not the rest of Canada. I would say, you know, most corners of America got played more than, you know, than even pretty well-traveled corners of Canada.
Wow. That's interesting. Tell us about some of the people that they toured with, because there was some hijinks, and they were definitely not treated very well by all of the bands they were opening for, but there were some big names they opened for. Tell us who some of them were.
Yeah, so I mean, early on it was Uriah Heep was the first one, and Uriah Heep guys were really quite nice to them and showed them the ropes basically, and they loved it and they were in awe and this was amazing. But they toured with Kiss early on, and they got on with Kiss. You know, Kiss, the guys in Kiss are real kind of musicologist, music lover guys, so they appreciated what Rush was doing, even though it was something totally different to them. But they all got along, and you know, they can appreciate the musicianship of Rush as well. And frankly, they probably didn't really feel that threatened by Rush either, because Rush was going to be hard to put over. You know, here's a band who's a progressive metal band. I mean, basically the first band trying to do a new genre, really. And so it's odd. And then you got Getty. It's this odd voice, and they three guys, they got their hands full, so they can't really go crazy on stage. So they're not challenging Kiss in the stage show, or even how good songs go over live, because simple songs in a bad live sounding environment sound better than complicated songs, right? So so they like having him as a support act. They don't feel threatened. Aerosmith apparently didn't treat them so well. They played a lot of shows with Ted Nugent. Boy, who else? Probably almost every single band from the 70s, they would have played with Cheap Trick and Styx and all these guys, because basically it wasn't as structured as it became, where you would have touring packages and you'd play 80 dates together. It was more like jump on, jump off. And even in between, you would play smaller gigs. You would play club gigs or theater gigs in between shows sometimes, just because it's so expensive to stay on the road. So yeah, Thin Lizzy, Queen, pretty much everybody. And then as they got a little bigger, they had the Baby Rush supporting them the whole time. Max Webster, who were a great, great band, also here out of Toronto. And they were there, you know, talk about the Canadian-ness and the loyalty. They had a Canadian band, but basically they had this small Canadian band supporting them pretty much all through their complete rise up until about 1980, 1981.
let's talk about the criticism. Boy, these guys, they got a lot of, they got hit with things on stage, right? Like bullet shells and bottles and stuff like that. But they also really got clobbered by some of these critics. And with the comparisons to Led Zeppelin as well. How did they deal with that?
Not that well. They really didn't like it. I mean, and they kind of will admit that. They're a little honest about that. It did really rankle them. It steeled their resolve, I guess, to go on. But they also, I think, probably at the same time realized that they were subtly going to be a little bit of a different band, more of a people's band, because when you became a fan of Rush, I mean, you could be a pretty fanatic fan, and there's lots for you to dig into. You could dig into the lyrics, you know, as a young guy reading Neil's, you know, lofty lyrics, you know, bringing up mythology and philosophy and all this stuff, and it was pretty flowery poetry, really. You know, so that could be really cool for a young kid. And also, if you were, you know, picking up a guitar or bass or drums or whatever yourself and learning, you know, they had a lot of chops as well. So they quickly became a people's band. But you're right. The critics, nobody likes a band who, you know, they think they can quickly compare them to someone else. You don't want to be considered a Zeppelin copy band or something, mm-hmm. which they quickly weren't anyways. I mean, eventually they were not that at all. But Geddy's voice is certainly a novelty thing. It's a novelty voice, right? Mm-hmm. It's very, very different. It's one of these voices that can make or break how much you like that band or not. And there's not that many bands in that league, and they are one of those. And then, as I alluded to before, I mean, the critics essentially like singer-songwriter stuff and roots music and blues and folk music and the Grateful Dead. And so it's essentially the whole critic class is the class that sort of married a little more to the coasts. And one, there's two things they don't like. They don't like heavy metal and they don't like progressive rock. So Rush had both of those, so they were getting it from both barrels, because here they were smooshing the two together like a Reese's peanut butter cup, and basically inventing progressive metal. So they're really sticking their head out there, or their necks out there, with two types of music at once that the critics don't like.
Yeah, that's painful. But you know what? It didn't bother them. They were doing it, you're right, for the people and for themselves, not for the label, not for the critics, which I think is so great. You started to mention Neil. Let's talk about Neil a little bit. Everybody knows that when you get – every music snob, myself included, knows that when you get the question, who's your favorite drummer, there is a correct answer, right? And every other answer is incorrect. So that being said – Martin, who's your favorite drummer and why?
That's interesting. It may not be Neil. It may be Neil. And I'll explain why Neil almost deserves to be considered the most famous drummer. But if you really are asking me and not expecting the answer, Neil, or you were, I would say, boy, you know what? It just might be Neil, but there are a few. There's John Bonham. There's Roger Taylor. There's Brian Downey from Thin Lizzy. There's Ian Paice from Deep Purple, right? There's Alex Van Halen. There's a lot of drummers I really like. Phil Collins, right? But Neil is in a certain class where I think a couple of things about Neil. I think he is probably the Beatles of drummers in two ways. One, he's probably the biggest inspiration on future drummers, just the way Beatles are the biggest inspiration on future bands. It goes Beatles and then it goes Kiss. And that's, I don't even think that's up for argument. But so Neil is probably the number one most inspirational guy who makes drumming look really exciting and fun with those huge sets and those big toms and all the percussion and the bells and everything, and just being almost like the center of attention in a Rush show. The other way he's like the Beatles is that he's almost like he almost writes songs on the drums or riffs. So if the Beatles are considered the greatest songwriters of all time, Neil, you know, with those tune tom things, you know, those great studied riffs that are played more or less the same all the time, he became, and this is not up for argument either, he is the most air drummed drummer of all time. So he's the most fun to air drum to if you're a drummer or even if you're not a drummer. And in that respect, he's writing hooks, songs, riffs on the drums more so than any other of these drummers that I just mentioned that I love for other reasons, right? Those are the cool things about Neil. And then the last thing I kind of like pointing out, but, you know, it's a little contentious, is that if you – you know, you the critics could say that Rush overplayed, like their egos are all over this stuff or something like that, right? Like they have such big egos that they have to show how great players they are all the time, right? That's up for debate, but you could say, you know, in certain instances, there's an element of overplaying. But what is overplaying? You know, the genius of what Rush did is if you're the only ones daring enough to do that, like to play a lot on a pop ballad like Closer to the Heart or Fly by Night, if you're the only ones daring to do that, you're the only band doing that. And that's kind of cool. You're unique just by doing that. You're doing something that a lot of critics think is in bad taste, but you are the only ones daring enough and courageous enough to do it. So that's the cool thing about Neil, too. You just totally notice this drumming, but some people might say it's a form of overplaying.
Right. Yeah, I guess I could see that, but I've never thought that until you're mentioning just now. I just thought that they were all very, very passionate. Passion is a word that is used a lot in the book. They really had a lot of passion for what they do, and I think that shows. The other thing about Neil, though, too, is and even he got some flack from, I think maybe Uriah Heep, somebody in Uriah Heep, I think, just like giggled a little bit when he would come in with his kit, because they're like, there's no way that guy is playing all that stuff. It was the same thing when he auditioned too, right? He came in with all this stuff and everyone's like taking a double take, like, who is this guy I think he is? But then he used it all. He uses every piece of equipment.
Yeah, and that again, if you are an aspiring drummer, you see all these extra cool little things you can do, right? And it's right. Like, you know, at a Rush show, oh, he's going to play the bells now, he's going to hit the gong now, or whatever, right? Or the tune cowbells. So Neil actually, you know, played little tunes sometimes on some of these things, right? And then, like I say, the tom toms, lots of tom toms and lots of cymbals and stuff. And then as time goes on, as you get into the 80s, he's even got like an electronic kit, and he turns around and plays an acoustic kit. So he's got all that going on too. He's got extra gizmos just through the rise of synth drums and things like that, right? So, so if you were in a band like Uriah Heep or whatever, and you saw this support band, I mean, it was just titillating to you as a musician. You just looked at these guys and said, wow, you know, that must be a lot of fun to play these complicated songs, right? And that's every musician loves those parts where they get to go and play the challenging part. Well, Rush, all of it was challenging, including, you know, fooling around with different time signatures and things like that. So I'm sure bands looked at him and said, man, it must be fun to be in Rush, because you do get to hit all these different things.
Yeah, absolutely. And Neil, just one more note on him. He's also the lyricist in addition to being the drummer, which that's kind of uncommon. But I love how well-read he was. He really did deserve the name, the professor, like you were just saying, you know, so many people could aspire to him and learn from him. And in that regard, he truly is a professor, and he's so well-read. I don't know if people really realize not just Tom Sawyer, but so many references. I had a million of them written down here, and I took so many notes. I took like 10 pages of notes of your book, and I can't find them all
there's
now.
Coleridge,
but I know
Xanadu, right? There's yeah. Ayn Rand, you know, early on. There's
John Steinbeck was in there. Yeah, you had so many. Yeah, a lot of references. And a
history and politics and that as well. Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the great things Neil left everybody, including everybody in the band, is I really do believe that sort of Renaissance man aspect of him drove Alex and Getty to become, you know, Renaissance men in their own rights. They had a lot of different interests as time went on. So I think instantly. You know, because they did not have a preponderance or a predilection to be writing the lyrics, and they frankly, if they had been writing the lyrics, they probably wouldn't have been that great for a long time, because they were just not that into it. So it was great that this guy took over. But I think as time went on, including his chops, I think he drove those two guys to be better men and better people and better thinkers and more thoughtful people in all aspects of their life as time went on. So I think that's a great sort of treasure that Neil left those two guys with.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so they, as you say, are the people's band. They do it for the people, but the record industry is an industry, and it is based on record sales and such. So with their second album, arguably second on Mercury anyway, Caress of Steel, that was a bust, and it almost cost them everything, didn't it? Do you think it was their management company that held Mercury to a contract that allowed them to get 2112 out. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's roughly right. I mean, basically, the management, everybody kind of like just politely in a Canadian way wanted them to write some hits. So Fly By Night did even a little better than Rush. And then Caress of Steel, as you correctly point out, almost, you know, crashed the band because it was too weird and too obscure and a little bit dark. But basically, you know, they were down in the dumps, but they decided, look, if we're going to crash, we're going to crash in flames dramatically. And they essentially went and made a very similar album to Caress of Steel. It was not that much more accessible. It was just way better done, I think. There are more, you know, vibrant and dynamic songs on it, more of them that start and end, despite, you know, the fact that one side is 2112. It's a concept album. It's better recorded. It was, I think, it had a much more full body, you know, bottom end on it. You know, it was spooky with the, you know, the red pentagram on it and mm-hmm. stuff. It's mm-hmm. a gatefold, you know, it's a second gatefold, but I mean, it's a cool looking record. And essentially, almost like in the nick of time, people decided, we accept this band. It's catching on. This is cool what we're doing. You know, prog rock is a pretty big thing in 1976. It's doing great. So basically, it basically got into people's mind frame or mindset that there's a great elevator pitch on this band. They're the heavy metal progressive rock band, right? It's just really obvious what they're doing. No one else is doing it. Let's accept it. And, you know, my earliest Rush memory, although certainly I'm pretty sure I knew the band two albums, probably three albums before this, but I remember, you know, sitting listening to Creme FM in Spokane, Washington, and they played the whole album. And, you know, this is before it actually came to town. So I'm sitting there ready to record it. And I recorded the whole thing. So, you know, radio was certainly on board. You know, I do subtly remember that even by 1976, I mean, basically everybody was on board thinking, like, they were slowly stopping making fun of this band and thinking of them as minor geniuses. Honestly, I mean, it frankly feels that way thinking back that you know, the new Rush album is in. We're going to play this whole album. It's a Canadian band, but we're going to play the entire album start to finish on FM radio.
And this is also where things started flipping for them, too. So they had opened for Uriah Heep in the beginning and Nazareth as well. And now those acts were starting to open for them.
Yeah, there was the odd time when that would happen, when those bands are on the descent. That didn't happen very often because essentially they were so loyal to Max Webster. They had Max Webster's support acts all the time. And then as you moved into the 80s, you got more the traditional thing where there was probably a little bit of politics about who supports you. But Rush was actually very good there as well, that they didn't succumb to the politics too much. They essentially took support acts out that they really thought were really cool and they'd like to show them to a larger audience. So you had bands like Primus and Mr. Big. They had Marillion back them up at a famous, you know, at a Radio City Music Hall stand. And they even had a period where they were, you know, trying to be a little more patriotic to Canadians, and they would take out, you know, smaller Canadian bands as support acts. But then eventually, you know, the show got so massive they couldn't deal with it. I mean, the stage was so complicated, you couldn't put a support act on stage because they'd bust something, essentially, right? Eventually they just had to go out as an evening of Rush, and again, value for your money. I mean, they would play a 3-hour show all the time then.
Absolutely. Well, they were amazing in concert and everything else. Martin Popoff's book, Anthem, Rush in the 70s, is now available from ECW Press.
It's the first in the Rush Across the Decades series. And that wraps up this track of Tex Prose and Rock and Roll. Thank you, Martin, for joining me today. You can learn more about my guest by visiting his website, martinpopoff.com. Be sure to join us next time when we sit down with the foremost authority on bluesman Robert Johnson, and we'll explore that infamous legend that Robert sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads. It gives me the chills just thinking about it. All right, here's this week's liner notes. Tex Prose and Rock and Roll was created, written, and executive produced by yours truly in association with GoTo Productions, Charlene Goto, producer. Special thanks this week goes out to Shelley Jeschetta and Joelle Fuller. Original music by Mike Bowman. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and comment wherever you found this podcast. You can visit us at textprosrockandroll.com or follow us on Instagram, where we love to hear from you. And yes, we do take requests. For Tex Prose and Rock and Roll, I'm Chris Kosach. Rock on.